G'day and welcome to a Grad Chat, your opportunity to find out about graduate research here at Queen's. My name is CJ the DJ and I am your host for this week's a Grad Chat. Of course, a show like this could not happen without the support of the School of Graduate Studies and Postdoctoral Affairs as well as CFRC. So thank you very much to both of them. Now, if you may miss the show at any time, you can download the podcast the next day on either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify and CFRC podcast. So no excuse not to hear what our awesome students and postdoctoral fellows are doing. Today, though, I'd like to introduce you to Zoe Brissot-Savasis, who is doing a Master's in Astroparticle Physics under the supervision of Dr. Nahi Park. Welcome to Grad Chat, Zoe.
Thank you so much, CJ. Thank you for having me.
That's really good. And it's interesting because one of the reasons I wanted Zoe to come onto the show is because this Thursday is going to be International Women's Day. And so I wanted to highlight today and over the next few weeks some of our amazing female researchers and how they're helping change how we look at things in the world. So thanks for putting your hand up to do that today for us, Zoe.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for reaching out to all of us and asking for this.
Well, I mean, you had the first hand up. It was awesome.
Oh, nice.
I go, yes, it worked. So we went like that. But before we specifically look at your research, because not every day someone says they're working in astroparticle physics, particularly, and I know this is going to sound bad, a female. But
that's true.
Good on you for doing that. But can we get a bit of a background on you in the first place? Now, why did you want to do this research? And what made you leave your home country of the Bahamas and your career? Because I understand you were working and then you've come back.
Indeed. So I never went to university when I was younger. Didn't really know what I was doing, what I wanted. And I had a good career and I had a nice life in the Bahamas. But I was deeply unfulfilled.
Right.
And so, you know, I'm 37 now. And I started this trajectory about 10 years ago. And it took some soul searching to figure out, okay, so if this isn't making you happy, like you're making good money, you have a nice partner, you have a nice life. If this isn't making you happy, what will?
What's missing?
Yeah. Mm. And so I did a lot of soul searching and figured out that I'm a very curious person and I need to know the why.
Yes.
One of those like little obnoxious kids who's like, why is this sky blue? Well, because of this. Well, why?
Why?
So
your mum and dad must have loved that.
Yeah. So if I can answer those questions for myself, then, you know, that really helps. So I decided to jump on the trajectory for physics, not knowing that it was going to end up in astroparticle.
Did you always have a fascination with physics?
Not particularly. No, when I was younger, I had more of a fascination with being lazy and smoking weed.
I love it. I think one of the nice things about education is that it's there every day for us, some in a more formal setting, such as a university or a college or high school and things. And other times it's what's going on around us. And with higher education, what is nice is there are a lot of people that come back to higher education because at the time when they were growing up, had no interest whatsoever.
Yep.
And a lot of people I know left probably school at 16 because they did not like going to school.
That was me.
But later, then they go, you know what? Now I am ready. You know, the mindset is ready and you have the focus for it. And so why not?
Yeah, it's always a little rough being, you know, 10 to 15 years older than everyone around you. And it was especially rough coming to Canada and saying, you know, hello, can I please have one university? And they said, because this was in Montreal, and they said, no, you have to do Cégep first. And so I went to Cégep and I said, hello, can I please have one Cégep degree? They said, actually, no, you're missing high school requirements. So I had to do high school classes at night, and then I had to do Cégep classes at night, and then I started doing my undergrad.
Wow, that is a long journey.
Yeah, so it's really easy, I think, to get discouraged when you have a big path like that.
Yeah, it would be discouraging because you think, well, I've just suddenly realized this is what I want to do, but I've got to go through all these hoops to get to the point that you want to do, i.e. the research. And there is some research you can do perhaps without a lot of the background information.
Yeah.
But I would gather something like physics or astrophysics is not one of those.
Oh, it's so hard to understand. Even when you're doing the classes constantly, you're just constantly wondering what the heck is going on. Yeah.
So why astrophysics?
So I kind of followed the women in my life, the women that I met in physics. When I did my undergrad, I was at Concordia University in Montreal, and there were not a lot of women in the department.
Right.
And one of the only ones, her name is Marianne Franck, and she is this brilliant theoretical astroparticle physicist, just like so incredibly well-spoken, so intelligent, is always like dressed incredibly, just impeccable taste. And I met her from her teaching a couple of classes,
right,
and then asked for a summer internship, a paid internship.
Okay, right.
And she actually really fought for me to get it, which was really incredible. She saw this person that was kind of having a hard time and trying to start over. And so she saw that and really fought for me to get this internship, which was brilliant because it was in the summer of 2020.
Oh, no. Okay, yes.
And so I went from doing just general physics to following this woman into astroparticle physics. And that was the first time I had ever really heard that that was a thing.
Right. And it went from there.
Yeah. And then when I applied to different universities, one of the universities that I was accepted to was here at Queen's. And one of the positions that I was offered was with this brilliant woman, Nahi Park. And, you know, I didn't really know what multi-messenger astrophysics was at the time, but she seemed really cool. And again, I just kind of followed one of the only women that I saw and kind of ended up In this path.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, first of all, you had the mindset to come back to school. And then, but clearly your mind was open to whatever. You just wanted to learn more about whatever.
Exactly.
And then you found this little niche area and then have followed that from then on. And I think that's the nice thing, again, about coming back. I know when, you know, I did my second, there was a gap between my first and second degree. And I knew when I came back, I was in a better mindset. Yeah. I could actually concentrate because I came back because I really wanted to do this, as opposed to it was the done thing you carried on from high school.
Like,
you went to university.
Better to do.
And yeah. Even though I knew exactly what I wanted to do from a young kid. And that's the path I followed. But it was a different, totally different mindset. And I think that bit more of maturity kind of helped, and that clearly has helped with you and following your passion. So with that, I guess we should get on. And, you know, it's part of this International Women's Day, etc., coming on. I mean, you've already mentioned a couple of very important women in your life that's helped you to where you are today, and of course you're carrying on that too in a topic or in a field of research that is predominantly men.
Mm-hmm.
Although I'd like to think it is changing slowly. Good on you for doing that. So your area is high energy neutrinos from extreme blazers. I'm assuming I'm saying that right.
Blazers. I think there's sometimes a distinction between blazer like you would wear and a blazar, which we call the star.
The star. Prototyping Ice Cube Gen 2 module. So it's a pretty long one. However, I guess you have to expect that when you think about space, because there's billions of years.
It's a big place.
It is a big place. Billions of space and billions of years in between. And so a little bit about that. I mean, there's a lot of things here that you talk about in your synopsis, you know, black holes, the South Pole, this place called Ice Cube, neutrinos. And the reason I know this word neutrinos now is because of Dr. McDonald.
Exactly, yeah. We're a little famous for it.
Yes, we are. So, you know, but I thought that was up at the Sudbury.
It is, yeah, absolutely.
Whereas you're looking at the South Pole.
We are.
Down in the South Pole. So explain a little bit about, you know, what do you mean by these high energy neutrinos, or even how you got into this path, look, and what you're actually trying to accomplish?
So the thing that Ice Cube and the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory have in common is that they are buried deep, deep, deep underground.
Mm-hmm.
And we do that because neutrinos can pass through lots of stuff. You could have a neutrino pass through a light year of lead and it would just keep going. Or maybe have like a 50% probability of stopping. So these particles are incredibly unreactive. And so
unreactive mean they don't get pushed aside anywhere. They just
They just stream through you without stopping. So, for instance, if I held my thumbnail out right now, pointing towards the sun, there would be about 86 billion neutrinos passing through my thumbnail every second.
A bit scary, isn't it?
But none of them react. You would be lucky if a single neutrino reacted anywhere in your entire body in your entire life.
That's which is why we don't feel it.
Yeah, absolutely. They're just passing through all of the atoms in your body. So they're so unreactive. So the way that we get around that is we say, well, what if we have a really big block of space, like just lots of volume for them to interact with? And then every once in a while, if we have the numbers game right, every once in a while, one of them will come and ping and one of them will interact.
Right, right.
And then the reason that we put them deep underground is so that everything else gets blocked. All of the other particles can't pass through kilometers of ice. They will interact. They'll scatter before they get down there.
Which makes sense.
So it's a great background removal tool to put things deep underground, same as the Sudbury Neutrino Observatory.
But it's not easy to, I mean, I know with Sudbury, that was an old mine, which they've converted.
Yeah.
What was down in the South Pole?
So, it's just ice. It is kilometers of ice. And what we've done is we've drilled these boreholes like 2.5 kilometers deep using these high pressure hot water drills.
Right.
And then we've lowered these detectors down. They're kind of just like cameras that are very sensitive to single photons. So they're kind of like a string of pearls, and you lower them down and you do lots of them. You do a huge array. It's a kilometer cubed volume that we're looking at.
But there are lots of drill holes.
Yeah. So we lower these little cameras down that are all in a string, and then we fill it back up with water and we freeze them into the ice. And then we've just got this great big area that has little dots, sporadic, just little cameras every once in a while.
Right.
And what happens is the neutrinos come and they've got this high, high energy. And when they finally interact with the ice, they let off this type of light.
Oh, right. So you're looking for the light, which is hard to, because speed of light and all that sort of thing is not easy to detect. But I'm sorry, I know I keep going back to the Sudbury. That, when you see the pictures, it's a big cave and this big globe thing in it, but you're saying you're not actually underground with them per se. The cameras are, but you are all on the surface and you're interacting with those cameras somehow with technology.
Absolutely. That's a good distinction. So with Sudbury, they can actually travel down to their detector.
Mm-hmm.
But with Ice Cube, we put these cameras in the ice. They're done. We can never access them again. They've just got power cables and data cables feeding back to the surface.
If they don't work, then you're cactus, as we say.
Yeah.
On that particular
you're
one.
You're done. Yeah, absolutely. It's a really fascinating procedure. I got to kind of monitor the experiment a couple of times and see, you know, which cameras are working and which ones aren't working. And I shouldn't be saying camera. They're called digital optical modules or DOMs. But I find camera is a little bit easier to think.
Yeah, for people like me.
People in general.
People in general. So you're working more with the Ice Cube then, with what you're looking for?
Yeah, I only work with Ice Cube. That is my collaboration that I work with.
Okay. So then, I mean, you're looking for these neutrinos, but what else? I mean, clearly they're pinging every now and then, but so what?
So what's incredible about neutrinos that other particles don't have in common is that they can pass through anything without really interacting. If you look at other particles in the universe, if we've got, you know, like cosmic rays, if we've got photons, if we've got, you know, other normal things, they bounce around quite a bit and mm-hmm. they lose information as they travel to us. But the very cool thing about neutrinos is that they're just carrying all of the information from their source in a little bag and just bringing it straight to us and dumping it at our doorstep.
Right.
So we can learn so much from looking at neutrinos because they're still carrying their source information so well.
And what kind of source information?
So for instance, I am looking at blazars.
Right.
Which is a type of black hole.
Okay. You got a black hole where everything sinks in.
Yeah. As far as we know, at the center of most galaxies, we call them AGN or active galactic nuclei. And there's just these supermassive black holes at the center of galaxies. And every once in a while, they've got these jets that are pointing out the top and bottom of them. So, you know, you've got this disk and it's ripping up all of this matter. And every once in a while, there's just stuff shooting out the top of the bottom, really, really energetic. And every once in a great while, those jets are pointed straight at the Earth.
Okay, right.
And that's what we call a blazar.
Okay.
That's when we have this little pointy jet straight at us that says, like, woo!
And that's very different to what comes behind, like, a meteor or anything like that.
Absolutely, but great question. So it's so incredibly energetic, these jets. They're one of the most energetic things in the universe. The speeds that things are ramped up to are unimaginable. They are really, really huge fractions of the speed of light. And so there's very, very energetic stuff happening. But what we aren't sure about is whether or not these jets have neutrinos coming out of them. And it's not the neutrinos themselves per se that we're super interested in, but the neutrinos would be a result of other particle interactions.
Okay. Yep.
And so if we can see the neutrinos, that means that there has to be other guys. There has to be like protons. There has to be what we call hadrons.
Okay.
So it's kind of like a smoking gun. Like, if we can see this, then we know that this other thing is happening.
But wouldn't you see some of those other things as part of this blazar? Because you said it's spewing out all stuff.
Absolutely.
And neutrinos is the hardest one to find.
Absolutely.
But the other stuff must be easier to analyze.
Very good point. But that stuff interacts on its way to us. It bounces.
So as you said, then you lose bits.
Exactly.
Bits go off.
Exactly, exactly. Especially charged particles, because there's huge magnetic fields all around the universe and all kinds of different structures. So especially charged particles are just getting bounced all around. And so most of them don't even get here. Or if they do get here, we don't know where they came from.
Right. Or they've been diluted.
Yeah, absolutely.
They don't have the same power.
And even the light that's getting to us, we know that it's been filtered. It's interacted with stuff on its way here.
So it's not pure.
Yeah, yeah. So we can kind of extrapolate what it used to look like, but we don't have that pure information like we do with neutrinos.
Neutrinos aside, sorry, I'm fascinated by the fact that these blazars have come out of these black holes, because I always thought black holes is like a sink.
Absolutely.
So, but you're saying these blazars, these are coming, spewing out, which is opposite to what you expect.
So I think we have to kind of zoom out a little bit. The black hole is at the very center of the active galactic nuclei. Mm-hmm. And a black hole is, you know, this really compact thing. And it's got something often called an accretion disk that is floating around it. So it's kind of like a plate or a ballerina skirt when they're spinning really, really fast.
Yep.
And so all of that stuff stays outside of the black hole, because most everything passes the event horizon of a black hole is never coming back out.
Right, right. So this is the outer boundary that so far could go in or out.
Exactly, exactly. Okay. So that is what is making up these jets. There's nothing that is, I misspoke when I say coming out of the black hole. It's coming out of this blazar, this active galactic nucleus. The black hole is a part of it, but it's also got this accretion disk. Sometimes it's got this thing called a dusty torus, if there's other ones. And then this jet is kind of ripping stuff out of this accretion disk. So it's all happening outside of the black hole, but the black hole is the engine for it.
It's the engine. Okay. So back to your neutrinos then. First of all, as you said, it's a long way it's got to travel for us to pick it up. And first of all, the blazar has to be pointing towards us. Secondly, even though other things along the way are getting shoved left, right, and center or disintegrating or whatever, these neutrinos are still going. But the ice cube is in one part of the world.
Mm-hmm.
How are these random neutrinos finding its way to ice cube for you to be able to monitor it?
So you can think of these jets as kind of widening a little bit. You know, it's coming from something that's already probably pretty big, but you can even think of it as a point. And then, you know, it's just like a little cone that comes towards us.
Right.
And so the Earth is getting bathed with neutrinos from all places at all times. And, you know, most of them are not blazars. Most of them are, you know, stars and the diffuse neutrino background. There's just so many of them coming from all these different places. So when we get a signal and we kind of try to trace it back to where it came from, we can't really say with any positivity, yes, this definitely came from this blazar, or yes, this definitely came from this Seyfert galaxy or any of the other guys, because you don't really work in absolutes in physics.
Even though neutrinos go through everything,
yeah,
you'd think it would have a straight line to
Absolutely.
Somewhere.
So even if that line is super straight, yeah, and even if we trace that line back and it points straight back to something that we know is a blazar, we will never say, hey, that is absolutely 100% positive. We're always going to say like, hey, we have, you know, like this 95% confidence interval that this is of astrophysical origin. And, you know, it's a huge statistics game that I never really considered before.
Did you like stats?
No. Crazy about it, but it turns out it's my whole field. So having to learn the heck out of it.
I wasn't that great with stats myself. So you talk about, I'm going back to your topic, the research topic, high energy neutrinos. Okay, we've figured out what they are from blazars, extreme blazars. Yeah, we've figured out what they are.
Jetty boys.
And, and where they come from. Prototyping Ice Cube Gen 2 module.
So that's a whole different thing.
Oh, it's totally different.
Yeah. So I've got two main projects going on, or probably more than two going on now, because I'm going to extend into my PhD here.
Yay.
But the other thing that I'm doing is I'm trying to build a prototype for the expansion of the experiment. So hopefully, if we get the funding for it, we're going to make the experiment much bigger, which is going to make it way more sensitive. We're going to be able to measure many, many more things if we can get this experiment to be larger. And the prototype that I'm trying to build is pretty cool because it won't be very costly. And hopefully, you know, if it actually works, it will be able to see more wavelengths of light than the current ones can see.
Right. So whenever I'm thinking about finding a piece of equipment that can analyze, you can have big machines and you have small machines. Clearly, you've got something there. And is it tweaking the algorithm, or is it more to it than that?
So there's really two main things that are going on. Well, I mean, there's lots of things, but there's two main things that are going on with the data taking for Ice Cube, or with, you know, data analysis with the whole flow. So there's the things that are actually in the ice. There's you know, the tech itself, which are usually pretty small and self-contained. You know, you can probably pick one up in your hands. Okay. The one that I'm building should be very small and very light and very simple.
Ah, so you can take it to other places.
Yeah. But then once the data is transferred to the surface, there's a whole other ball game of things that need to happen. There's a lot of machine learning that happens,
right,
to try to interpret these signals, because, you know, there's just all these cameras that are just constantly flashing. It's so much data.
And what does it mean? What does each flash mean?
Exactly. And so you're trying to find a track, you know, so that if all of these cameras are constantly flashing, you're trying to figure out, okay, but what was the actual source? You know, which of these flashes are actually from a neutrino signal? Which ones of these are noise?
Oh, yeah. So even under, I guess even underground, you're still going to get some noise, as you call it, coming through.
Because you do get other signals that aren't what you're looking for. And then you also just like nothing is perfect. The DOMs, the optical modules.
They must be generating
absolutely
noise
absolutely
themselves.
So you need huge algorithms and
to cut those bits out. If you're hearing this, don't worry. But if you're hearing this, let's look at it more closely.
Yeah. So there's a lot of really incredible machine learning and other tools that are going into creating these data sets that we can actually use.
So with the data sets and everything like that, and you're finding these neutrinos, and you said you're wanting to see where the source for the neutrino came from and what else is in there. What are you finding? Are you finding anything other than it sparks this light?
So I couldn't tell you yet. You know, there's lots of different analytical tools that I'm using to try to figure out, you know, do I have a signal from one of them? You know, what if I stack the signals from all of them and kind of layer them on top of each other and see if that's statistically significant? But even if I do get something that's statistically significant, I can't write a paper and say, I have done it.
Yes.
There's neutrinos from blazars. I can write a paper that says like, hey, so I have, you know, 95% confidence that this, I have, you know, some 68% confidence that this is happening. This is my region that things might be coming from.
And with what you're doing, can that be used for other scenarios?
So, yeah. So what I'm doing is tiny, teeny, tiny slice of what Ice Cube is doing.
Right.
You know, we've got hundreds of members and, you know, most people are not doing anything related to what I'm doing.
Right.
There's, you know, there's people that are working on neutrino oscillations. There's people that are actually, I can't even list the things that people are working on, because literally hundreds of people.
Right. But do you ever chat with each other? Because, you know, sometimes because you're working just one very, very small part, you might need to know what the other things are going on, because that could have an impact on your thinking.
Absolutely. The left hand should know what the right hand is doing.
So do you do a lot of that, a lot of collaboration in terms of this is where I'm up to, what are you up to?
Absolutely. We have two collaboration meetings per year. We have one in the spring, one in the fall. And, you know, we've also got our Slack channel, and you make connections with people so mm-hmm. easily because you're both so fascinated with the same things.
And, right.
And everyone gives a talk about, you know, what they're doing and their research is. And, you know, you go through the schedule and you say, oh, that looks interesting. That looks interesting. That looks. And then you show up to these talks and then you have dinner with the person and you say, oh, you're also doing wavelength shifting materials. Can we talk about that? How did you source this? What were your results?
Yeah. And, you know, if I told you this, would that change your mind?
Yeah, absolutely.
Kind of thing. I actually think some of those things is what's the most fascinating, because this is why I like doing this, you know, doing grad chat, because I get to hear about different work, and from one day to another, I'll have someone in this section of pathology doing a little protein and one cancer, and another one in pathology doing a different protein in the same cancer, and never the twain shall meet. But it's still fascinating to see, you know, this is just a tiny, tiny little bit, and yeah. Neutrinos are even tinier, I'm sure, than any of those. So with these conversations and things that you have, and thinking about coming back into education, you've aligned yourself with very strong women in the field, in the various fields, one in your undergrad and then now again in your grad. Are you finding other women in your particular area, not necessarily specifically on the neutrino part, but in astrophysics itself, are you finding, and maybe you'll find more when you do your PhD, more women that you can reach out to? Not saying we should ignore what the men are saying, far from it.
But no, community is important and representation is important.
Yeah. Are you finding that at all, or are younger women coming through who are also have an interest in astroparticle physics?
So it's actually incredible how many women are in the astroparticle program now.
Great.
I am surrounded by women in my classes, in my working group. We are half women.
Fantastic.
But there is the leaky pipeline.
Ah. What do you mean by that?
So, you know, you go through your undergrad and there might be 50% women, and then you go through grad studies and there are going to be
drops off a bit
more difficulties faced by gender minorities and racial minorities. And
right.
Then as you go on to grad studies, and then as you go to looking for postdocs and looking for positions, there's always going to be more challenges mm-hmm. for people mm-hmm. who are underrepresented.
Right.
And so by the time you get to, you know, faculty positions and permanent positions, that representation that was there in undergrad is no longer there.
Mm-hmm. Which is a shame, because, you know, we need lots of different ideas out there from different perspectives, different backgrounds. In general, we need that. So hopefully you'll keep going with that. So what's your end game for this research? Yeah. Is there one, or is it just a pure fascination and taking that next step to help whatever the next experiment could be?
Yeah, I think.
Because what are we hoping to find with these neutrinos? It's out there.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah. I mean, so.
What does it do for me? What does it do for us on the ground?
The really cool thing about what we call multi-messenger astrophysics is that we are looking at neutrinos. But we can also look at photons. We can also look at cosmic rays. You know, classically, we could only really look through telescopes to learn anything about space. But now that we've got, you know, gravitational waves and all of these other messengers, if we can put all of those messages together mm-hmm. and get the big picture of what's going on in the universe, then we get to solve problems so much more efficiently. So, you know, you could ask me the question of, you know, why study astrophysics? How is it important to humankind? How do we justify spending money on these things when we could be spending it on healthcare? And, you know, these questions are always there. Healthcare should have more
yes.
money going towards it.
Yes.
But so should science. We're
yes.
not well funded either.
Yes.
And I think to answer that, you know, science answers these very fundamental questions. Apart from, you know, curiosity and our place in the universe, you know, learning more about the fabric of reality and you know, the nature of particles, that's going to help in all fields.
Yes.
You know,
including health.
Yeah. And, you know, including fabrication of materials, you know, do you want a smaller cell phone? Figure out how particles work good. Granted, astroparticle is probably not the most direct route there. But
we've always had this fascination with space. I mean, we've all looked up into the sky and wondered, you know, how far is that star? And, are we alone? Which we'd be naive to think that we are the only living thing in the universe and beyond.
Very big place.
Yes.
So. I had a boss who would always ask me, well, what's the point? What's the point of studying astrophysics? What's it going to do for me? And I was like, you know, like if you don't have any curiosity about the universe, that's not my problem.
No, and I do. So I'm going to go and do it. there's always a connection somehow, even if we don't always realize it, I think. Okay. So I know you've had these strong women. So Dr. Park, I mean, I know you kind of fell on your lap to a point that you got to work with Dr. Park, and clearly she's doing some great stuff. But what are some of the other things they're doing other than these experiments? What else is she trying to do there to help, for instance, more women get into a field that is not always perceived as something feminine?
Yeah. You know, I think just the fact of her existence is incredible because, you know, as my story shows, representation matters. I literally followed the women. You know, there were so few women,
yes,
and my entire life path has happened because that representation was there. But she's also kind of incredible in her commitment to diversity and equity and inclusion.
Right.
We have a community agreement that we go through twice a year and that we all read out loud together and that we all have the option of adding to or taking away from.
Okay.
Which is so nice to sit down together and really verbalize it on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, this is not okay. This is not okay. This is how you deal with that. This is who you go to if this happens. If you don't want to talk to me about it, this is who you talk to about it.
Right.
She's created such a good environment, which I don't think a lot of people do.
That's great.
And she's also included a lot of women in the group, which I love. I love having a group that is half women. I've never had that in my life.
Totally different perspectives on things.
Yeah. So it's really incredible to
be
around.
She seems extremely supportive. And
she is.
And
she really is.
Which I think is really, really important. Not enough of that these days, of us supporting each other. And sometimes women can be their worst, can be the worst enemies, right?
Yeah, it's very
because
true.
Because sometimes I've been in environments where you think the women would be supporting you, but they're actually trying to knock you down for some reason. And they think, well, hang on a minute.
Yeah, like maybe it's subconscious. Maybe they've got their own stuff that they're
correct
not working through.
So it is, as you said, really nice when you get into an environment where that is not happening.
No, it's such a conscious decision that she's made to create and foster this environment.
That's great. Well, you've found the right one there then, haven't you?
Yeah, I'm going to do my PhD with her as well.
Oh, fantastic. See, that's always a nod, isn't it? When the student wants to continue into the next degree, into it. Well, Zoe, this has been fantastic. What a great way to start for International Women's Day. So I really do appreciate you coming on the show and giving us your insight into neutrinos and ice cube. And these blazars and black holes.
Thank you so much.
Of different things there. Yeah.
Thank you so much for having me, CJ.
No worries at all. Thank you. If you want to see some pictures from Ice Cube, there is actually a public gallery at icecube.wisc.edu/gallery. And you can sort of see some of the pictures that they're able to get from Ice Cube. So maybe you want to do that. Yes. I look through some of them. I go, okay, I need to ask more questions. So anyway, that's it, everyone. Another week of Grad Chat sadly comes to an end. Don't forget, you can download the show tomorrow from either iTunes, Google Podcasts, Spotify, and CFRC Podcast. Just type in Grad Chat. Until next week, this is CJ the DJ signing off with a big hooray.
Thank you for listening to this podcast produced at CFRC 101.9 FM at Queen's University, situated on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe and Haudenosaunee peoples, and brought to you by the generous support of the Faculty of Engineering and Applied Science.